Welcome to the first episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies, a discussion of Star Trek, what it means to us, and from what it looks like from our perspective. I'm your host, Matt Ross, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Pontone. Say hi, Mike.
Hello. Greetings.
Let's talk a little bit about ourselves. I'm a longtime Star Trek fan, and I've seen all of the original series. And I understand you're kind of a noob to this type of thing.
In proper description, I'm a long-term Star Trek fan as well. I was watching from when I was born in 1985. I would gather around the old Sony television with the parents every Saturday night and watch TNG on Channel 11. And that being said, my main background is on The Next Generation, and then it's a direct spinoff show, Deep Space Nine. That's where my heart is. And I know the movies like the back of my hand, because those movies were much more in the same vein as TNG than they were the original series. In reality, I've never seen any of the original series, except for the episode that we just saw, that Matt was kind enough to show me, which was Season 1, Episode 1, The Man Trap. Dr. Leonard Bones McCoy meets a former girlfriend when the Enterprise brings supplies to a remote archaeological survey group. Still attractive to McCoy, the woman's current appearance has a dark and deadly secret.
Yes, that's actually, I actually like it. It's odd is that that's actually the first episode shown out of sequence. They had originally wanted to do The Cage, but just to let you know, I grew up in the 70s, so we saw it on the huge zenith in my living room. When I mean we, it was just me. And I had only had the original series until the movies and Next Gen, and I know them backwards and forwards, having run a Star Trek club and gone to many of the conventions and so forth. So we're going to have discussions from a noob to a seasoned Star Trek, or actually original series Star Trek fan, and what we thought of it. And we just got finished seeing The Man Trap, or Episode 1, which just as a side, which I'm sure a lot of people already know, it was shown because the executives wanted a Monster of the Week episode as opposed to something more intelligent or deep founding, which is later in The Cage and also where no man has gone before. So
let me also just point out, the Monster of the Week thing, you can see how that set the stage. It's amazing to look at how the very first foundation of a series kind of echoes throughout, because there were plenty of Monsters of the Week in TNG. There were, I mean, Voyager was almost exclusively a Monster of the Week.
And Forehead of the Week.
And Forehead of the Week, yes. You know, DS9 got away from that, but they got away from that by essentially starting a brand new era of television of serialized long-form stuff. And, you know, everything that we watch today, Battlestar Galactica, The Expanse, all of this stuff stems from when DS9 did it for the first time and broke the mold of a kind of Monster of the Week formula. Anyway, this is not the DS9 Appreciation Podcast.
Not yet.
Yet. We're starting with the basics. My good buddy Matt is taking me under his wing to show me and let me get me to appreciate the original stuff.
Well, I'll just say I like this episode. It's a dark and kind of twisted episode. And the main thing they keep talking about is the extinction of an entire race. Mm-hmm. Like the end of the buffalo, as Captain Kirk, our titular hero, actually says throughout the entire thing. And also as the bad guy, so to speak, Professor Crater notes that this planet was teeming with these aliens all over the place and had one thing that they needed, which was salt, which the human body seems to have an abundance of, and the crew starts dying right away.
Yeah, not the Vulcan body.
Not the Vulcan body, though. They happen to be bred on a separate...
From a different sea.
Yes, exactly. Like, but just going from the beginning, I actually enjoyed it, and even though we know it's a set, by looking at it, I thought it kind of conveyed a nice, interesting look with the decayed buildings, or rather the ruins and stone. And you already know that there's something a little bit off. You got Kirk acting, though, like a human, talking unlike some other shows out there. You actually get the feeling that the people that we're dealing with know each other. There's a gentle ribbing around over there, talking about Bones is meeting his ex-girlfriend and giving her flowers. And there's that human interaction between Kirk, McCoy, Darnell, our soon-to-be-dead crew member.
Not a red shirt.
Not a red shirt.
A red shirt without a red shirt.
Exactly. And Professor Crater, when we meet Nancy, who at first looks like she's 27 or maybe 30, and then looks maybe closer to 40-something, and then Darnell's fantasy of a blonde...
19-year-old go-go dancer.
Go-go dancer in there, and like that. Suddenly everyone's realizing, are we looking at the same person? I thought it was kind of interesting that none of them knew what they were looking at, but it was kind of interesting. What did you think of that?
Well, they are messing around with a little bit of their own rules there, because at first it's obvious that everyone is perceiving her differently. And then she becomes a shapeshifter.
Well, the professor actually says, when they actually run into Professor Crater, he goes, next time you see her, I'm sure she'll look what you expect her to be like. So when you have that in there, it's kind of leading it into there. I think Professor Crater maybe have some sort of psychic connection with the soul, with the creature there, which we don't know yet, but...
Well, in high sci-fi and superheroes, there are two different types of shapeshifters. You want to call them the Odo shapeshifter, which is the foundling, which is like, hey, I'm going to change my body to look like someone else. Or the fairy shapeshifter, which is a glamour, right? Mm-hmm. They're putting up something. This, I would argue, is obviously like a glamour shapeshifter, or else how could she possibly appear as different creatures to different people at the same time?
Well, they obviously have some sort of psychic connection. Everyone sees something slightly different. But after the first meeting, Nancy lures young Darnell away to who knows what they were going to be doing over there.
Darnell has clothes on. But he was laying down.
He was laying down, that is quite sure, on a rock at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
But while Professor Crater gives sass to Dr. McCoy and Captain Kirk about how he doesn't want to be bothered, we hear a scream, and Kirk and McCoy run out there, and we see these little, like, almost like hickeys on his face, or round circles.
Which I have to say, again, smart writing. I always appreciate it in writing when people are not just calling out, like, this is because of this. So, for instance, at the very end, when we finally see the Sol Vampire, an observant viewer can see that the Sol Vampire has little suction cups on its hands, which is obviously where it's calling it out. I guarantee you that at some point someone said, should we have a line that says, look, the hands have suction cups just like the rings? And someone said, no, the audience, even in 1966, is going to be smart enough to put that together. We can just show them. They'll figure it out.
Yep, it's good. It was a good moment over there. But it was interesting because at that point you didn't understand. And then, although it's probably budgetary because they didn't want to keep doing dissolves into the face of what right. Nancy looks like, she then looks like the more middle-aged woman that she is for the rest of the episode. But the fact that we don't know what exactly happened, even at that moment, you have no idea. Could Nancy have killed this guy? Could someone else have killed this guy? And then it starts on this murder mystery tour of what it is that could be done. No one really knows. It was something interesting, though. You pointed out to me when they were coming back to the ship, you thought that Spock and Uhura had a thing, because in the later J.J. movies, Spock and Uhura had a thing. But from looking at this, and I remember when I actually first saw this, when I was substantially younger, I never ever got that impression. I got the impression that Spock and Uhura were just trying to be a smart aleck to him, because Spock has, and this is trying to show he has no emotion, so it actually does that as a kind of informs the audience, like, I have no emotion, I don't care what happens. When he's told, there's a death in the landing party, and Uhura says, that could be your friend, after she says, why don't you tell me I look beautiful? It's right. Like, yeah, he's not interested.
I appreciated that J.J. Abrams, terrible filmmaker that he is, and writer. I mean, a writer who's just like, well, we've got these gaping holes. We could spend a month trying to figure out good explanations, or we can just shoot the damn thing. And he always seems to go for the latter option. But the point is that I had never seen TOS, and I'd only seen the movies. And in the movies, there's no hint of romantic feelings between any of them. I mean, they're all in their 50s. Accordingly, it's nice to see that wasn't done in a vacuum. There was definitely some flirty energy, as if J.J. Abrams might have... had his production assistant watch the first 5 episodes and like, okay, give me the breakdown of what everyone's doing. I'm going to base my script on that.
Well, but, I can see that. I mean, but JJ's hack writing, because you could already tell what my opinion is of his work. I don't think, even though from this is the first episode aired, but it's actually supposed to, I believe, be the third or fourth one in series orders. I don't think there's supposed to be a romance between Uhura and Spock, but
no.
There it's there anyway.
Not romance, just a little bit of energy.
I got you.
And by the way, quick aside, I really appreciate it. I'm saying, like, okay, what do we see here that extends out to future Trek? I like seeing a non-captain holding the chair. Demonstrates that, okay, it's kind of a command of the ship rotates. Just
you mean
like
with
in a
Spock
real
holding it, like, as the executive officer?
Yeah.
That's his job. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, it demonstrates that they're committed to kind of an actual Navy command style, that when the captain's off the ship, there's always someone in charge. That there's deference to superior officers, with the two crewmen giving deference to Uhura when she comes out of the turbo lift. Talking about Uhura was very, very cute. I was surprised at how attractive that she was. And yet, you know, you have an African American young woman in her 20s whose sexuality is on the forefront. She comes out of the turbo lift, the guys kind of give her deference, they move aside.
Well, there's a professionalism on everyone there. There's no tears or like, I feel this every 5 seconds. And yes, I'm taking a dig at Star Trek Discovery where everyone seems to cry every 20 seconds. Here, there is a level of professionalism between all the characters inside. You've got Kirk clearly in command, giving orders to everyone, showing that he's in charge, but he's not a jerk to everyone. He knows what he's doing, he communicates what he's looking for, but he's also not an absolute hard ass on everyone in there. He acknowledges that McCoy made a mistake in being like obsessed with his ex-girlfriend, so to speak, and making a mistake in the medical diagnosis, but he's not holding it against him because he knows he's dealing with a competent officer. He's also dealing with the other members of the crew, and he's talking to them in a professional way. He talks to Sulu, the helmsman, about setting the ship on general quarters. He talks to Spock about what it is that could be there. And there's also this little back and forth, like the jokiness is like, he tells McCoy, like, if you need to sleep, why don't you take one of those red pills you gave me?
This is the 60s. Everyone was on recreational pills for everything.
It shows a professionalism. They're saying, like, listen, you know, just take it. But he's a gentle ribbing all the way through.
Right.
There's no question that everyone in here knows exactly what they're doing and what their job is and what they have to do to try and get to the bottom of things. Spock's the unemotional one. Sulu is efficient. There's we don't know this yet 100%, but it's Yeoman Rand, the one with the checkerboard hairpiece.
Yeah.
She goes in there. We can address anything from that point on, like between the hand puppets or what do you...
Well, I mean, it was a nice escalation where, okay, fine, there's some sort of killer on the planet, and at first you think, okay, maybe it's going to get to the bottom of this. Then the killer gets out. The killer goes straight to the ship. And, oh my goodness, like, that's a good way to move the plot around, where you're saying, okay, is it going to be a bunch of people coming down to this vacant place trying to figure out what's going on? No, it's good writing. They're like, well, how about the threat goes into the hen house and is going around trying to figure out, and the heroes of the story are trying to figure out what's happening. And I'm a big Star Trek Picard Season 3 fan, let me just note that. Season 1 and 2 is some of the worst writing I've ever seen. I really like Star Trek Season 3. And what do we have in Season 3? We have an entire episode of them trying to figure out who the changeling is on the Titan. And let me tell you, it runs very closely to the energy that we have here, where they're talking about what are we dealing with? Who is the person? Now, you know, you could argue that that's already been done in DS9 during the changeling saga, but I'm just saying that if this is not a direct comparison, I don't know what is. I mean, the two episodes are almost, shot for shot.
Well, you know, this over here, again, it shows you that, so I guess you could say there's nothing new under the sun, but, you know, and this is doing it first, or at least in the Star Trek universe,
yes,
doing it first. It's kind of like, what's going to happen next? And again, you get the impression that it's not just a two-room set, it's the actual ship with other people on there, other officers, other crewmen. Suddenly you have some guy in like a vest who's, I believe, damage control, He's dead.
I assume that he was engineering, because the engineering in the movies are often portrayed as wearing radiation suits.
Well, they never really say what it is, but I always could liken it to damage control. In another episode, you'll see like that guy running in the hallways, but then again, everyone's running in the hallways. Right. But you have a full ship of crew people over here, everyone's doing their jobs. And then, but then you have the concern of like, you know, who's this other guy on the ship? And the neat thing I thought, the person who, second person murdered after Darnell is Green. When Green comes to the ship, he acts as if he was an alien in a strange place. Yeah. He has no idea. He can't figure out how to open up the doors. He has no ideas. The tell of him biting his finger that he needs salt all the time. He's looking around. But like he follows Yeoman Rand into the Arboretum where Sulu is. He's the plant expert. He loves botany. And I think you said that was new to you. You didn't know that.
I did not know that he had a botany background.
He's the plant guy. They go in there. They see a hand puppet plant over there, which freaks out when now crewman Green is in there, not talking. And
which, let me say again, a bit of good writing.
Yeah. No.
What would a sentient plant not want?
Yeah, not salt. To be, that's right, a sentient plant would not want salt or something that's going to be a harm, and it acts out in some strange way, and everyone's like, what the heck's going on? We don't know what's going on, and he leaves the room because he's afraid it's going to be, the creature is afraid it's going to be found out.
Right.
And that's where you see Uhura get out of the way as an officer. Crew members move out of the way. They don't say, oh, dude, I'm just moving here.
Right.
They actually move out of the way, and she tells one of them, you need to fix my door. Is exactly what she said. Can you come to my place? Yes, ma'am. And then she runs into some person that she's never seen before who speaks Swahili, which is a nice touch because that's the background of Uhura, which you have to learn from the Apocrypha, but she comes from the United States of Africa.
Oh,
and she speaks Swahili natively. She meets in one other person who speaks Swahili. You would think with a crew of 430 people,
well,
she would know something, especially as communications.
But you see, this is the interesting thing, too. I appreciated that. Again, I thought this was only a TNG thing, that the Enterprise was essentially like kind of considered to be a floating city. I always thought that the original series Enterprise was much more of a Navy vessel. I was surprised to see that there was an arboretum there, actually, because I knew that it didn't have like a holodeck or anything. So it was surprising to see, like, okay, there are a lot of random people. Maybe he got on at the last, you know, stop over at Deep Space 5 or something, and there's a rotation. Also, he's not an officer. He's not wearing a Starfleet uniform.
Well, he's wearing his karate gi crewman shirt.
He's wearing his Bolian special. He might be a barber for all we know.
But that's actually neat. It's that you're realizing it, that there's an actual crew. Not everyone is ensign, like a lot of modern Star Trek calls today. There's crew people. It is a Navy ship. It's
right.
There's rank, structure, and order.
Yes.
And you actually, at least to me, what this felt like to me is that you were on the ship in some regards. And I was watching, what was on the left and right side of the doorways? And where do all those rooms go to? Where does the bridge go? And that's part of the charm to me of this episode, is just fine, or any of them, actually, the original series.
I mean, I am blown away. Like I said, every Star Trek I've ever seen, every series, it takes a little bit to get its footing, right?
Mm-hmm.
One could even forgive Star Trek Picard because
no.
Most... Well, I mean, yeah, I don't. But I'm just saying that it follows the rule that every Star Trek series really needs one or two first seasons to get going. My brother, I didn't watch Star Trek Enterprise, but my brother is a much more hardcore fan than I am of all things Star Trek, and he swears up and down that Star Trek Enterprise gets good in the third season.
Wow,
and
that's debatable.
I can definitely attest that Voyager got better in the third season, and it's common knowledge that DS9 and TNG got better in the third season.
But that's what makes this an anomaly, because TOS was actually good from the first season, and the third season is known as the worst season overall.
Right. The point being that they hit the ground running so hard, so fast, with so many things, that now, literally 60 years later, are still setting the framework for what Star Trek is. And, you know, just as like a big old fanboy, I'm like, well, that's an amazing thing. When you look at comparable Star Trek, science fiction media, it stumbles and fumbles and it's all over the place. I mean, look at the wreck that the Star Wars franchise is in right now.
We can discuss that in another pod.
Well, I'll give you 30 seconds on it, right? Three great films, made 40 years ago, and then three mediocre films that at least had a plot, and then three pointless movies that were obviously made by AI and committee, and then another 100 hours of dreck to streaming. Like, it's no question that Star Trek, pound for pound, hour for hour, is a better written, executed franchise. And it's because it always had this kind of core. What is Star Trek? What is it supposed to be? And, you know, neither one of us like Discovery or Strange New Worlds. Quoting the great, late great Mike Sulcasa, may he never die, actually. We can't get into the concept of Star Trek naval officers talking like teenagers at a mall.
Well, that's missing here. That's true.
But that, to wit, at least it always follows the kind of message of a naval ship of very competent people who like each other pushing through unknown circumstances, which this nails it in the very first episode from the very first frame.
And you get the idea that they're part of something bigger.
Yes.
That's what it means to me. It was like a sense of adventure, a sense of mystery, and I wanted to know what was going to happen in the episode after this. But when we finally get to the point where we're going on, I mean, there is a bunch of cheesiness. I'm not going to deny that in there, but I actually...
What's the cheesiest part?
I think the cheesiest part in this is Spock slapping the crap out of Nancy when I think... McCoy should have shot the creature immediately, but he was stunned. I always find that scene hilarious, but it's funny in a way is because I want him to shoot, but I understand he's stunned. He can't believe that this Nancy who throws Spock away against the wall like a toy is an alien.
And can I just point out something too that stunned me and surprised me in a very fun way? That the Starfleet officers in 1966 and the Starfleet Law officers in TNG, Voyager, and DS9 all do the double-fisted
punch. It's all the Kirk fist. That's how I tell you.
The double-fisted punch must be taught in, like, you know, the Krav Maga of Starfleet.
I wouldn't do that. It'd probably hurt my knuckles. But I do like this one line right before they finally corner the creature where they figure it out. And you have to wonder, so the creature is doing this, eating or sucking the salt out of people, the salt sucker of M113, as this is the planet that it's called. You know, you have to wonder, now it's kind of like a kid in a candy store. It's surrounded by humans and aliens that are in salt. There's a starship that has salt in it, and it listens in the briefing room while pretending to be Dr. McCoy, as Kirk accusing Dr. Crater. It's like, so let me get this straight. This alien creature is your lover, your friend, and it could be anybody, and you pretty much are blackmailing it for salt. That's kind of sick, actually, when you think about what Dr. Quaid is doing. His wife gets murdered by this creature 2-3 years ago, and now he is sleeping with this alien in exchange for salt, possibly. It's a little gross when you think about it.
It is, but you have to consider... I mean, there are lots of things... I'm going to take this back around, too, and compare it to the Twilight Zone, because
in many ways,
this could have been a Twilight Zone episode. You cut it down to 30 minutes, and you take out the starship part. Easy. Well, no, you keep the starship part in, but basically you make it leaner and just have it be a generic Air Force thing. But the point is that the guys there on the planet alone, right? It might have been like, make love to the salt creature, or go insane.
Well, same thing for the salt creature. The salt creature is losing its mind as well. It needs love just as much as salt. That's right. It needs love as much as salt. Just like any of us would if we were alone all the time. You know?
Something that did not really pay off, and I don't know if this was underwritten or if they were acting the scene wrong, when they're at the briefing table and he says, you know, you can tell who it is. Does he know that it's McCoy? Because if he does, it's not obvious.
No, I think he knows. He looks at that scene which you're talking about in the briefing room where they're deciding, we know the creature's aboard the ship. Dr. Crater, can you identify it? He actually side-glances McCoy. He does know who it is.
I was looking very hard. I didn't see that.
He looks directly at him. He says, yeah, I can identify it. I'm just not going to help you. He knows who it is, and that's when Kirk says, so basically you're treating this thing as your slave. I think that was the point where the creature itself realized, hey, you're right. I am being treated poorly, and I'm going to take every opportunity I can to escape. And
Dr. Crater's the first one that she kills after that.
That's the first one after that.
Right.
She tries to take out Spock.
Right.
But she can't.
Right.
And, but that's...
His green blood is not salty.
That's not... He's not a salty guy. Not yet, anyway. But I found it a rather enjoyable type of thing. So what do you think? You want to sum up what it means to you? And what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm stunned that it was... that it had so much of modern Trek in what was perceived to be the very first episode. Obviously, as a big fan of the films, there were big old glaring questions. I brought this up while we were watching it, that they bring up the idea of a truth serum, and I said, well, why don't they just do a mind meld? And you told me mind melds have not been developed yet as something that Vulcans can do. Their psychic powers are secondary, or have not been
Right, it hasn't yet. Been actually written in yet, that's right.
And then, also, it's a small cast. It really is just a trio. It's McCoy, Kirk, and Spock, and everyone else is supporting. It did not become really an ensemble because there was no Scotty and there was, of course, no Chekhov. He wasn't in the first season. You saw, what, 10 seconds? Not 10 seconds, but not very much
Rand
and Sulu.
Right.
But they were all passing and they did not contribute to the story at all.
Not really. Not I really. Mean, they were just ancillary, and for the most part, they were ancillary characters throughout. But that actually made it interesting is that you're focusing on the Trinity, and you find out how everyone kind of melds into it. And it was it's a fun adventure story, and it makes you. Would you like to see the next one? I would assume on to see how we go on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hooked. Honestly, in a weird way, I'm kind of assuming that it's not going to be as good.
Well, you know, we'll just have to wait and find out. I will tell you this: everyone calls this the pilot. It's not actually a pilot. It's a full episode.
It doesn't seem like a pilot at all.
It's not. The Where No Man Has Gone Before and The Cage are the two pilots that were actually commissioned to start the Star Trek franchise. The Cage first, which was famously not actually shown in its full parts until the 80s. But we'll come to that as into it. For me, it was a lot of fun and adventure, and I'm glad that you actually liked it, and we'll suffer through all of these and this and our future podcasts.
Why suffer?
It's not suffer. Actually, we're going to have a great time, and we will journey to all the undiscovered countries yet to happen.
Yes, so, with the help of some Romulan ale.
Yes,
Romulan ales.
What was
before
it?
We started.
Blue Curacao.
Blue Curacao, Navy Strength Gin, although I didn't actually go get Navy, it's just regular gin, lemon juice, and an egg white.
There you go.
And topped off with tonic water. And let me tell you, it was delicious.
And it makes the episodes go that much smoother. So thank you for joining us. We hope you like it. And we hope you like, share, and tell everyone about us. And we'll hope to see you next time at Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Take care. Live long
and prosper.